The Secret of Chimneys, Agatha Christie, Chapter 26, The 13th of October. At 10 o'clock on the morning of Wednesday, the 13th of October, Anthony Cade walked into Harridge's Hotel and asked for Baron Lollapreschel, who was occupying a suite there. After suitable and imposing delay, Anthony was taken to the suite in question. The Baron was standing on the hearthrug in a correct and stiff fashion. Little Captain Andrassy, equally correct as to demeanor, but with a slightly hostile attitude, was also present. The usual bows, clicking of heels, and other formal greetings of etiquette took place. Anthony was by now thoroughly conversant with this routine. "You'll forgive this early call, I trust, Baron," he said cheerfully, laying down his hat and stick on the table. "As a matter of fact, I have a little business proposition to make to you."
"Ah, is that so?" said the Baron.
Captain Andrassy, who had never overcome his initial distrust of Anthony, looked suspicious.
"Business," said Anthony, "is based on the well-known principle of supply and demand. You want something, the other man has it. The only thing left to settle is the price."
The Baron looked at him attentively, but said nothing. Between a Herzoslovakian nobleman and an English gentleman, the terms should be easily arranged, Anthony said rapidly. He blushed a little as he said it. Such words do not rise easily to an Englishman's lips, but he had observed on previous occasions the enormous effect of such phraseology upon the Baron's mentality. True enough, the charm worked.
"That's so," said the Baron approvingly, nodding his head. "That is entirely so."
Even Captain Andrassy appeared to unbend a little, and nodded his head also.
"Very good," said Anthony. "I won't beat about the bush any more."
"What's that you say?" interrupted the Baron. "To beat about the bush? I do not comprehend."
"A mere figure of speech, Baron. To speak in plain English, you want the goods, we have them.
The ship is all very well, but it lacks a figurehead. By the ship, I mean the Loyalist Party of Herzoslovakia. At the present minute, you lack the principal plank of your political program. You're minus a prince. Now supposing, only supposing, that I could supply you with a prince."
The Baron stared.
"I do not comprehend you in the least," he declared.
"Sir," said Captain Andrassy, twirling his mustache fiercely, "you are insulting."
"Not at all," said Anthony. "I'm trying to be helpful. Supply and demand, you understand. It's all perfectly fair and square. No prince is supplied unless genuine. See trademark. If we come to terms, you'll find it's quite all right. I'm offering you the real, genuine article, out of the bottom drawer."
"Not in the least," the Baron declared again, "do I comprehend you."
"It doesn't really matter," said Anthony kindly. "I just want you to get used to the idea. To put it vulgarly, I've got something up my sleeve. Just get hold of this. You want a prince. Under certain conditions, I will undertake to supply you with one." The Baron and Andrassy stared at him. Anthony took up his hat and stick again and prepared to depart.
"Just think it over.
Now, Baron, there's one thing further. You must come down to Chimneys this evening. Captain Andrassy also. Several very curious things are likely to happen there. Shall we make an appointment? Say, in the council chamber at 9 o'clock? Thank you, gentlemen. I may rely upon you to be there?" The Baron took a step forward and looked searchingly in Anthony's face.
"Mr. Cade," he said, not without dignity, "it is not, I hope, that you wish to make fun of me."
Anthony returned his gaze steadily.
"Baron," he said, and there was a curious note in his voice, "when this evening is over, I think you will be the first to admit that there is more earnest than jest about this business." Bowing to both men, he left the room. His next call was in the city, where he sent in his card to Mr. Hermann Isaacstein. After some delay, Anthony was received by a pale and exquisitely dressed underling with an engaging manner and a military title. "You wanted to see Mr. Isaacstein, didn't you?" said the young man. "I'm afraid he's most awfully busy this morning. Board meetings and all that sort of thing, you know. Is it anything that I can do?" "I must see him personally," said Anthony, and added carelessly, "I've just come up from Chimneys." The young man was slightly staggered by the mention of Chimneys. "Oh," he said doubtfully, "well, I'll see." "Tell him it's important," said Anthony. "Message from Lord Caterham?" suggested the young man. "Something of the kind," said Anthony, "but it's imperative that I should see Mr. Isaacstein at once." 2 minutes later, Anthony was conducted into a sumptuous inner sanctum, where he was principally impressed by the immense size and roomy depths of leather-covered armchairs. Mr. Isaacstein rose to greet him. "You must forgive my looking you up like this," said Anthony. "I know that you're a busy man, and I'm not going to waste your time more than I can help. It's just a little matter of business that I want to put before you." Isaacstein looked at him attentively for a minute or two out of his beady black eyes. "Have a cigar," he said unexpectedly, holding out an open box. "Thank you," said Anthony. "I don't mind if I do." He helped himself. "It's about this Herzoslovakian business," continued Anthony as he accepted a match. He noted the momentary flickering of the other's steady gaze. "The murder of Prince Michael must have rather upset the apple cart." Mr. Isaacstein raised an eyebrow, murmured, "Ah?" interrogatively, and transferred his gaze to the ceiling. "Oil," said Anthony, thoughtfully surveying the polished surface of the desk. "Wonderful thing, oil." He felt the slight start the financier gave. "Do you mind coming to the point, Mr. Cade?" "Not at all. I imagine, Mr. Isaacstein, that if those oil concessions are granted to another company, you won't be exactly pleased about it." "What's the proposition?" asked the other, looking straight at him. "A suitable claimant to the throne, full of pro-British sympathies." "Where have you got him?" "That's my business." Isaacstein acknowledged the retort by a slight smile. His glance had grown hard and keen. "The genuine article? I can't stand for any funny business." "The absolute genuine article." "Straight?" "Straight. I'll take your word for it." "You don't seem to take much convincing," said Anthony, looking curiously at him. Hermann Isaacstein smiled. "I shouldn't be where I am now if I hadn't learnt to know whether a man is speaking the truth or not," he replied simply. "What terms do you want?" "The same loan, on the same conditions, that you offered to Prince Michael." "What about yourself?" "For the moment, nothing, except that I want you to come down to Chimneys tonight." "No," said Isaacstein with some decision. "I can't do that."
"Why?"
"Dining out. Rather an important dinner." "All the same, I'm afraid you'll have to cut it out for your own sake."
"What do you mean?"
Anthony looked at him for a full minute before he said slowly, "Do you know that they've found the revolver, the one Michael was shot with?"
"Do you know where they found it?"
"In your suitcase."
"What?"
Isaacstein almost leapt from his chair. His face was frenzied. "What are you saying? What do you mean?"
"I'll tell you."
Very obligingly, Anthony narrated the occurrences in connection with the finding of the revolver. As he spoke, the other's face assumed a grayish tinge of absolute terror.
"But it's false," he screamed out as Anthony finished. "I never put it there. I know nothing about it. It's a plot."
"Don't excite yourself," said Anthony, soothingly. "If that's the case, you'll easily be able to prove it."
"Prove it? How can I prove it?"
"If I were you," said Anthony gently, "I'd come to Chimneys tonight." Isaacstein looked at him doubtfully.
"You advise it."
Anthony leant forward and whispered to him. The financier fell back in amazement, staring at him.
"You actually mean..."
"Come and see," said Anthony.
Chapter 27. The 13th of October continued. The clock in the council chamber struck 9.
"Well," said Lord Cadaham with a deep sigh, "here they all are, just like little Bo Peep's flock, back again and wagging their tails behind them."
He looked sadly round the room.
"Organ grinder complete with monkey," he murmured, fixing the Baron with his eye. "Nosy Parker on Throgmorton Street."
"I think you're rather unkind to the Baron," protested Bundle, to whom these confidences were being poured out. "He told me that he considered you the perfect example of English hospitality among the haute noblesse."
"I dare say," said Lord Cadaham. "He's always saying things like that. It makes him most fatiguing to talk to. But I can tell you, I'm not nearly as much of the hospitable English gentleman as I was. As soon as I can, I shall let chimneys to an enterprising American and go live in a hotel. There, if anyone worries you, you can just ask for your bill and go."
"Cheer up," said Bundle. "We seem to have lost Mr. Fish for good."
"I always found him rather amusing," said Lord Cadaham, who was in a contradictory temper. "It's that precious young man of yours who's let me in for this. Why should I have this board meeting called in my house? Why doesn't he rent the Larches or Elmhurst or some nice villa residence like that at Streatham and hold his company meetings there?"
"Wrong atmosphere," said Bundle.
"No one's going to play any tricks on us, I hope," said her father nervously. "I don't trust that French fellow, Lemoine. The French police are up to all sorts of dodges. Put India rubber bands round your arm and then reconstruct the crime and make you jump, and it's registered on a thermometer. I know that when they call out, 'Who killed Prince Michael?' I shall register 122 or something perfectly frightful, and they'll haul me off to jail at once."
The door opened and Treadwell announced, "Mr. George Lomax, Mr. Eversley."
"Enter Cotters, followed by Faithful Dog," murmured Bundle. Bill made a beeline for her, while George greeted Lord Cadaham in the genial manner he assumed for public occasions.
"My dear Cadaham," said George, shaking him by the hand, "I got your message and came over, of course."
"Very good of you, my dear fellow. Very good of you. Delighted to see you."
Lord Cadaham's conscience always drove him on to an excess of geniality when he was conscious of feeling none.
"Not that it was my message, but that doesn't matter at all."
In the meantime, Bill was attacking Bundle in an undertone.
"I say, what's it all about? What's this I hear about Virginia bolting off in the middle of the night? She's not been kidnapped, has she?"
"Oh, no," said Bundle. "She left a note pinned to the pincushion in the orthodox fashion."
"She's not gone off with anyone, has she? Not with that colonial Johnny. I never liked the fellow. And from all I hear, there seems to be an idea floating around that he himself is the super crook. But I don't quite see how that can be."
"Why not?"
"Well, this King Victor was a French fellow, and Cade's English enough."
"You don't happen to have heard that King Victor was an accomplished linguist, and moreover, was half Irish?"
"Oh, Lord! Then that's why he's made himself scarce, is it?"
"I don't know about his making himself scarce. He disappeared the day before yesterday, as you know, but this morning we got a wire from him saying he'd be down here at 9 p.m. tonight, and suggesting that Cotters should be asked over. All these other people have turned up as well, asked by Mr. Cade."
"It's a gathering," said Bill, looking round. "One French detective by window, one English ditto by fireplace, strong foreign element. The Stars and Stripes don't seem to be represented."
Bundle shook her head.
"Mr. Fish has disappeared into the blue. Virginia's not here either. But everyone else is assembled, and I have a feeling in my bones, Bill, that we're drawing very near to the moment when somebody says, 'James the footman,' and everything is revealed. We're only waiting now for Anthony Cade to arrive."
"He'll never show up," said Bill.
"Then why call this company meeting, as Father calls it?"
"Ah, there's some deep idea behind that, depend upon it.
Wants us all here while he's somewhere else. You know the sort of thing.
You don't think he'll come then?
No fear. Run his head into the lion's mouth? Why, the room's bristling with detectives and high officials. You don't know much about King Victor if you think that would deter him. By all accounts, it's the kind of situation he loves above all, and he always manages to come out on top.
Mr. Eversley shook his head doubtfully.
That would take some doing. With the dice loaded against him, he'll never...
The door opened again, and Treadwell announced,
Mr. Cade.
Anthony came straight across to his host.
Lord Cadaham, he said, I'm giving you a frightful lot of trouble, and I'm awfully sorry about it, but I really do think that tonight we'll see the clearing up of the mystery.
Lord Cadaham looked mollified. He had always had a secret liking for Anthony.
No trouble at all, he said heartily. It's very kind of you, said Anthony. We're all here, I see. Then I can get on with the good work.
I don't understand, said George Lomax weightily. I don't understand in the least. This is all very irregular. Mr. Cade has no standing, no standing whatever. The position is a very difficult and delicate one. I am strongly of the opinion...
George's flood of eloquence was arrested. Moving unobtrusively to the great man's side, Superintendent Battle whispered a few words in his ear. George looked perplexed and baffled.
Very well, if you say so, he remarked grudgingly, then added in a louder tone, I'm sure we're all willing to listen to what Mr. Cade has to say.
Anthony ignored the palpable condescension of the other's tone.
It's just a little idea of mine, that's all, he said cheerfully. Probably all of you know that we got hold of a certain message in cipher the other day. There was a reference to Richmond, and some numbers. He paused. Well, we had a shot at solving it, and we failed. Now, in the late Count Stilpich's memoirs, which I happen to have read, there is a reference to a certain dinner, a flower dinner, which everyone attended wearing a badge representing a flower. The Count himself wore the exact duplicate of that curious device we found in the cavity of the secret passage. It represented a rose. If you remember, it was all rows of things, buttons, letter E's, and finally, rows of knitting. Now, gentlemen, what is there in this house that is arranged in rows?
Books, isn't that so?
Add to that, that in the catalogue of Lord Caterham's library, there's a book called The Life of the Earl of Richmond, and I think you'll get a very fair idea of the hiding place. Starting at the volume in question, and using the numbers to denote shelves and books, I think you'll find that the object of our search is concealed in a dummy book, or in a cavity behind a particular book.
Anthony looked round modestly, obviously waiting for applause.
Upon my word, that's very ingenious, said Lord Cadaham.
Quite ingenious, admitted George condescendingly, but it remains to be seen.
Anthony laughed. The proof of the pudding's in the eating, eh? Well, I'll soon settle that for you. He sprang to his feet. I'll go to the library. He got no farther.
Monsieur Lemoine moved forward from the window.
Just one moment, Mr. Cade.
You permit, Lord Cadaham?
He went to the writing table and hurriedly scribbled a few lines. He sealed them up in an envelope and then rang the bell.
Treadwell appeared in answer to it.
Lemoine handed him the note.
See that that's delivered at once, if you please.
Very good, sir, said Treadwell.
With his usual dignified tread, he withdrew.
Anthony, who'd been standing, irresolute, sat down again.
What's the big idea, Lemoine? He asked gently.
There was a sudden sense of strain in the atmosphere.
If the jewel is where you say it is, well, it's been there for over 7 years. A quarter of an hour more doesn't matter.
Go on, said Anthony. That wasn't all you wanted to say.
No, it wasn't. At this juncture, it's
unwise to permit any one person to leave the room, especially if that person has rather questionable antecedents. Anthony raised his eyebrows and lighted a cigarette. I suppose the vagabond life's not very respectable, he mused. 2 months ago, Mr. Cade, you were in South Africa. That's admitted. Where were you before that? Anthony leaned back in his chair, idly blowing smoke rings. Canada, Wild Northwest. Are you sure you were not in prison? A French prison? Automatically, Superintendent Battle moved a step nearer the door, as if to cut off a retreat that way, but Anthony showed no signs of doing anything dramatic. Instead, he stared at the French detective and then burst out laughing. My poor Lemoine, it is a monomania with you. You do indeed see King Victor everywhere. So you fancy that I am that interesting gentleman. Do you deny it? Anthony brushed a fleck of ash from his coat sleeve. I never deny anything that amuses me, he said lightly. But the accusation is really too ridiculous. Ah, you think so? The Frenchman leant forward. His face was twitching painfully, and yet he seemed perplexed and baffled, as though something in Anthony's manner puzzled him. What if I tell you, monsieur, that this time, I am out to get King Victor, and nothing shall stop me? Very laudable, was Anthony's comment. You've been out to get him before, though, haven't you, Lemoine? And he's got the better of you. Aren't you afraid that that may happen again? He's a slippery fellow, by all accounts. The conversation had developed into a duel between the detective and Anthony. Everyone else in the room was conscious of the tension. It was a fight to the finish between the Frenchman, painfully in earnest, and the man who smoked so calmly and whose words seemed to show that he had not a care in the world. If I were you, Lemoine, continued Anthony, I should be very, very careful. Watch your step and all that sort of thing. This time, said Lemoine grimly, there will be no mistake. You seem very sure about it all, said Anthony, but there's such a thing as evidence, you know. Lemoine smiled, and something in his smile seemed to attract Anthony's attention. He sat up and stubbed out his cigarette. You saw that note I wrote just now, said the French detective. It was to my people at the inn. Yesterday, I received from France the fingerprints and the Bertillon measurements of King Victor, the so-called Captain O'Neill. I have asked for them to be sent up to me here. In a few minutes, we shall know whether you are the man. Anthony stared steadily at him. Then a little smile crept over his face. You're really rather clever, Lemoine. I never thought of that. The documents will arrive. You will induce me to dip my fingers in the ink, or something equally unpleasant, and you will measure my ears and look for my distinguishing marks. And if they agree? Well, said Lemoine, if they agree, eh? Anthony leaned forward in his chair. Well, if they do agree, he said very gently, what then? What then? The detective seemed taken aback. But I shall have proved then that you are King Victor. But for the first time, a shade of uncertainty crept into his manner. That will doubtless be a great satisfaction to you, said Anthony. But I don't quite see where it's going to hurt me. I'm not admitting anything, but supposing, just for the sake of argument, that I was King Victor. I might be trying to repent, you know. Repent? That's the idea. Put yourself in King Victor's place, Lemoine. Use your imagination. You've just come out of prison. You're getting on in life. You've lost the first fine rapture of the adventurous life. Say, even that you meet a beautiful girl. You think of marrying and settling down somewhere in the country where you can grow vegetables. You decide, from henceforth, to lead a blameless life. Put yourself in King Victor's place. Can't you imagine feeling like that?
I don't think that I should feel like that, said Lemoine with a sardonic smile. Perhaps you wouldn't, admitted Anthony. But then you're not King Victor, are you? You can't possibly know what he feels like. But it's nonsense, what you're saying there, spluttered the Frenchman. Oh, no, it isn't. Come now, Lemoine. If I'm King Victor, what have you against me, after all? You could never get the necessary evidence in the old days, remember? I've served my sentence, and that's all there is to it. I suppose you could arrest me for the French equivalent of loitering with intent to commit a felony, but that would be poor satisfaction, wouldn't it? You forget, said Lemoine. America! How about this business of obtaining money under false pretenses and passing yourself off as Prince Nicholas Obolovich? No good, Lemoine, said Anthony. I was nowhere near America at the time, and I can prove that easily enough. If King Victor impersonated Prince Nicholas in America, then I'm not King Victor. You're sure he was impersonated? That it wasn't the man himself? Superintendent Battle suddenly interposed. The man was an impostor, all right, Mr. Cade. I wouldn't contradict you, Battle, said Anthony. You have such a habit of being always right. Are you equally sure that Prince Nicholas died in the Congo? Battle looked at him curiously. I wouldn't swear to that, sir, but it's generally believed. Careful, man. What's your motto? Plenty of rope, eh? I've taken a leaf out of your book. I've given Monsieur Lemoine plenty of rope. I've not denied his accusations. But all the same, I'm afraid he's going to be disappointed. You see, I always believe in having something up one's sleeve, anticipating that some little unpleasantness might arise here. I took the precaution to bring a trump card along with me. It, or rather he, is upstairs. Upstairs? Said Lord Caddaham, very interested. Yes. He's been having rather a trying time of it lately, poor fellow. Got a nasty bump on the head from someone. I've been looking after him. Suddenly, the deep voice of Mr. Isaacstein broke in. Can we guess who he is? If you like, said Anthony, but... Lemoine interrupted with sudden ferocity. All this is foolery. You think to outwit me yet again. It may be true what you say, that you were not in America. You're too clever to say it if it were true. But there's something else. Murder. Yes, murder. The murder of Prince Michael. He interfered with you that night as you were looking for the jewel. Lemoine, have you ever known King Victor to murder? Anthony's voice rang out sharply. You know as well, better than I do, that he has never shed blood. Who else but you could have murdered him? Cried Lemoine. Tell me that. The last word died on his lips as a shrill whistle sounded from the terrace outside. Anthony sprang up, all his assumed nonchalance laid aside. You ask me who murdered Prince Michael? He cried. I won't tell you. I'll show you. That whistle was the signal I've been waiting for. The murderer of Prince Michael is in the library now. He sprang out through the window, and the others followed him as he led the way around the terrace until they came to the library window. He pushed the window, and it yielded to his touch. Very softly, he held aside the thick curtain so that they could look into the room. Standing by the bookcase was a dark figure, hurriedly pulling out and replacing volumes, so absorbed in the task that no outside sound was heeded. And then, as they stood watching, trying to recognize the figure that was vaguely silhouetted against the light of the electric torch it carried, someone sprang past them with a sound like a roar of a wild beast. The torch fell to the ground, was extinguished, and the sounds of a terrific struggle filled the room. Lord Caddaham groped his way to the lights and switched them on. Two figures were swaying together, and as they looked, the end came. The short, sharp crack of a pistol shot, and the small figure crumpled up and fell. The other figure turned and faced them. It was Boris, his eyes alight with rage. "She killed my master," he growled. Now she tries to shoot me. I would have taken the pistol from her and shot her, but it went off in the struggle. Saint Michael directed it. The evil woman is dead.
A woman? Cried George Lomax.
They drew nearer. On the floor, the pistol still clasped in her hand, and an expression of deadly malignity on her face, lay Mademoiselle Brune.